The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is a lecture given by Dr. Ira Sohn on June 18th of 2004 in Santa Monica, California. The talk was sponsored by the Southern California Federation of Scientists and the Monthly Review Discussion Group. The lecture was titled, The Materialist Conception of History. Dr. Sohn holds degrees in physics and economics and currently teaches economics at universities both in the U.S. and China. The complete talk has been divided into three parts, and this is part two.
So, having said that, now, can there be such a thing as permanent ideological hegemony? In other words, can a class, some ruling class, anywhere in the world, have so much control over people's minds that they remain sort of permanently enslaved? If you want to look at Plato's parable of the cave, like they're always in the cave. They never get out. They're always deluded by mirages, shadows. And unfortunately, this is the tack taken by people like Noam Chomsky, who writes books called Engineering Consent, where he says, well, you know, we're kind of surrounded by TV and movies and books, manufacturing consent, there's sort of almost perfect ideological hegemony. There's no escape from the cave. Well, you can ask, well, how in the world does it happen that thousands of people attend his lectures and read his books? He's really a best-selling author, and I've gone to lectures of his where there could be 1,000, 2,000 people there. So the hegemony is not perfect. There are a lot of people who dissent. Was the ruling class really interested in having an anti-war movement in the 1960s? Were they interested in having a civil rights movement? Or, you know, any of the other movements that we see, an environmental movement, a feminist movement, there are many movements that obviously are not to the liking of a ruling class. So there must be something wrong with that notion of perfect ideological hegemony. And what's wrong with it is that in the end, material interest prevails. The workers may be deluded in some way that they don't need a raise in their wage, but if there's inflation, if prices are going up, sooner or later, no matter what they hear from the Harvard Business School, they're going to go on strike. Or in some way demand a higher wage. If the U.S. proclaims month after month that it can see the light at the end of the tunnel in Vietnam, but the body count keeps rising, and more towns are captured by the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese, there comes some point when people say, well, wait a minute, the generals don't know what they're talking about. Johnson is lying or something. Something is crazy. In other words, reality will eventually break through. As Lincoln said, you know, you can fool some of the people some of the time, etc., but you cannot fool all the people all the time, not because people are geniuses, but because material interest is there. It's pushing from behind. People may not be aware of what their interest is exactly. They may not see the connection between their interest and their ideas, but it's always there. As an example, let me give George Washington. Up until January 1776, he was against separating from England. Because after all, he was the richest man in the country, had more slaves and more acreage than anyone else, and it was all based on tobacco, and the British Navy was guarding the ships, its own ships, which carried the tobacco from the U.S. to England. They didn't carry it to the continent, so that British tobacconeers were making a lot of money. And also, they prevented the development of an American commercial fleet. But Washington was happy with that because the prices he was getting for his tobacco were pretty good, and he was very, very wealthy. However, the British Empire ran into trouble with France, eventually with Napoleon, and so they began squeezing the colonies for more and more money, and they passed ever harsher navigation acts, which made it more and more difficult for people like Washington to make any kind of a profit. And finally, he realized in January 1776, he was facing bankruptcy. He found out that the prices that the British tobacconiers were getting from the Dutch tobacconiers, who then were distributed over the continent, was 15 times what they were paying him. In other words, Britain was this middleman that was overwhelming. If he could just get around Britain, then, you know, his gigantic estates and his wealth and, you know, all of that would be preserved. So before January 1776, he wrote a famous letter to one of his friends, put me down as a traitor if I ever even suggest separation from the mother country. Well, after January, he's singing a different tune. Now, had you given him a lie detector test and said, well, you know, do you really believe this? He would have passed. He was not a hypocrite. His material interests were reshaping his thinking constantly. And at some point, it was enough to make him say, let's separate. Now, had you pointed out to him this, you know, contradiction, he would have been able to argue in favor of his reasoning. He would have said, well, conditions were such and such back in 1773, and they're different now. Humans are very ingenious, as we all know. Anything can be rationalized. Anything can be justified. And in fact, we're always doing it. Usually innocently, sometimes not so innocently. But we're generally always trying to convince ourselves of the legitimacy of a path of action that corresponds to our interests, or what we can understand our interests to be. We can get confused, but if we feel X is our interest, we're going to move in that direction, roughly speaking. And it may be in conflict with something else we believed years ago. So the ideological scene is very complicated, and it's a battlefield. The Chase Manhattan Bank has its troops at NBC, you know, going out, and, you know, maybe KPFK or Midnight Special, you know, it's doing its thing, and it matters, probably, that the battle is raging. I'm not sharing Noam Chomsky's point of view that somehow one class can completely dominate the society it rules. Ideologically, it can't, but I think, and I can't prove it, that it's important for people who don't like this particular social form to enter the ideological arena and put forward their ideas. I mean, that's why everyone who's in this room is here today. I think it makes a difference. Sometimes small numbers of people who are very well organized, who have a really good conception, can influence enormous numbers of people who are kind of stumbling around looking for a worldview, looking for an answer. Does that mean that I think the American working class is going to embrace a revolutionary ideology tomorrow? No, I don't. If there's a big decline in the economy, a serious recession or a depression, you bet they're going to be listening to other voices, because they can't afford not to feed their children, even for one day. And if someone says, well, the reason you're in trouble is this, and the way to get out of the trouble is that, they'll at least listen. Will they absorb the ideas? Well, who knows? But to be presented with an alternative sometimes can be a very powerful thing. We all know of people whose lives were transformed by one teacher or one parent or one mentor of some kind, saving them from a lifetime in prison or something like that. Malcolm X was sort of like that. He was thrown into a prison for theft, and he encountered someone who was also in prison, who was a member of the Black Muslims, who recognized Malcolm was brilliant, but, you know, it's like a diamond in the rough, and said, hey, you got to start reading and figuring out the way the world works. And that changed his life, obviously. He turned from a criminal to, you know, a brilliant orator and great political leader. So everyone in this room can play a transformative role, because there are times when people are really ready for a new take on life, a new conception. So let me go on and spell out the materialist conception of history the way Marx laid it out. I mean, he didn't use my approach. He had a somewhat different approach. It was kind of formal and maybe not so easy to get through, but in essence, it's what I've told you. And I'll try to reconstruct his reasoning, you know, why he came up with this particular approach. First of all, he was working with a lot of the insights of the French Enlightenment and also the British Enlightenment, who recognized the existence of classes. By the way, it was a lot easier to do it then than now. If you ask a typical American, well, what class are you? Well, I'm in the middle class. How many people are in the middle class? Well, practically everyone. Because Bill Gates goes into a voting booth and he pulls a lever. You go into a voting booth, pulls one lever per person. And isn't that democracy? Well, there are other levers that Bill Gates can pull that most of the rest of us can't. But if, you know, you don't know about that and you're going on the basis of what you learned in junior high school from your civics teacher, you might accept the fact that we really are a gigantic middle class. But in Marx's day, there was no question that there were classes. Feudalism was still going strong in Germany, and to some degree even in France. It had been abolished in England before he was even born. But in England, everyone knew, you know, who was in the aristocracy and who wasn't. You just had to listen to a person speak, and you could hear an Oxford accent or a Cambridge accent. And who went to Oxford and Cambridge in those days? Well, you know, only the very rich. And you could detect a Cockney accent. Marx lived kind of near them. And, it, you know, it obviously was a person in the working class, and the class lines were very sharply drawn everywhere in European society and to a certain extent in American society. There were no illusions about George Washington's wealth and power. There have been economic analyses of the writing of the Constitution, and every single person who signed was some kind of a prosperous lawyer or merchant or land speculator or currency speculator. This was the elite, the financial elite, of American society. In fact, the reason that they made it so hard to vote, you had to have a lot of property, is that they didn't want ordinary people voting, because the Constitution was almost not ratified by the 13 states. What ordinary people were afraid of was that it would be a British-type system all over again. It's going to be a big government. It's going to be controlled by the wealthy. And, you know, it's going to participate in oppressing us some way or other. And the votes were often very close. And so the ruling class of America at that time tried to ensure its victory at the polls by excluding most Americans. Apparently 3 or 4% of all Americans were allowed to vote for the Constitution and then in the first presidential election. And you just look down the list. Well, women couldn't vote. That's half the society. Blacks couldn't vote. Poor farmers couldn't vote. So-called mechanics, who were really factory workers, they couldn't vote. When you get down to it, it's 3 or 4% of the people who are pretty much in George Washington's class. So it wasn't hard for Marx to see that there were classes, and the French had already postulated that classes struggle, and in Marx's day, you could see it. The Chartist movement in England had several hundred thousand members, and they would take to the streets bitterly to protest child labor, because adults had to compete with children in factories, and a working day that would only be 10 hours, not 12 or 14, or some kind of a vaguely decent wage, vaguely bearable health and safety conditions. Charles Dickens was writing, you know, when Marx was actually in his 20s. What kind of society is he describing? Engels came to Marx's attention because he wrote a famous book called The Condition of the Working Class in England, and it was horrific. So the existence of classes and class struggle and fierce class struggle was an established fact. He just took that for granted. The French had talked about it decades before, and they even talked about exploitation. They had that word. And Marx defined it very carefully, but they had the notion that some people are in a position to appropriate the wealth produced by other people. It's exploitation. You could see it easily in feudalism. It was less easy to detect under capitalism, but Marx applied his method to capitalism and was able to show that it too was a system of exploitation. So he had a lot to work with, but he wanted a rigorous theory, one that would explain not only his own society. Obviously, he was interested in capitalism, but the theory, to be sound, had to explain all societies. Newton didn't say, well, I'm just explaining the solar system. Newton said, well, you know, two particles attract one another no matter where they are. As long as they have mass, it could be, I don't know if they had the conception of light years in his time. It could be separated by a billion light years. They're still going to attract. Now, when you apply his laws of motion and gravitation to the solar system, you know, you get his explanation. But he had to have the most general theory possible. And Marx believed the same thing. He said, I have to be able to explain every society. Societies that are class divided, societies that are not. Societies that are feudal, societies that are capitalist, even societies one day that will be socialist. He needed the most general possible theory. And so he had to ask himself the question, well, what do all societies have in common? Well, they're all producing something or other. Human beings are not like fish. They can't just swim around and find food there. They have to do something. They have to hunt it. They have to gather it. They have to have factories. They have to engage in the act of production, and every society does. Some societies might be hunting and gathering societies, others industrial societies, but they all gotta work, and they work collaboratively. There are no Robinson Crusoes out there, each one on an island. We are very social animals, and we cooperate in the act of production. We may have a division of labor, where certain people do some things and other people do other things, but all societies must produce, and they must produce in some kind of collective manner. So these are big advances. And he then looked at, you know, how societies are organized. Well, he didn't know too much about hunting and gathering societies in his day, but there were other anthropologists who were working at his time who were reporting that they're kind of egalitarian. No one seems to be rich. No one seems to be poor. They're all at the same level. They may choose a chief when they go out to war, but that's just a person who's a chief for war purposes, and it's because he's really good at war, or maybe he's a really good hunter. Or maybe she's a really good gatherer, but they have no authority. They can't make anyone do anything that the person doesn't want to do. So they're egalitarian, but then you look at all modern societies that he was aware of, and then far from egalitarian. So using, again, a lot of the ideas that came from the Enlightenment and also that were produced by socialists in England and in America, he forged his model of capitalist society. Now, Who were these socialists in America and England? Well, they were called utopian socialists. Each one was very unhappy with the way capitalism was organized. And that was common. Lord Byron made speeches in the House of Commons denouncing the treatment of factory workers and mining workers. And Shelley was, you know, his friend, the great poet Shelley, was also a socialist. So there were a lot of these people who operated on a moral basis, not a materialist basis. They said, well, capitalism basically is immoral. A tremendous amount of wealth is concentrated in a small number of hands, and everybody else is, you know, working 14 hours a day in a mine or a factory. There's something terribly inequitable and brutal about that, and we should change. And they felt that the best way to change was a sort of the Confucian way, set an example. So there were these experimental movements or communes that were set up in America and in England and maybe France, where people cooperated in production and everybody had pretty much the same standard of living and the children were well educated. And they were, roughly speaking, egalitarian. Well, somehow the millionaire owners of factories in England and France were not inspired by these examples to change the way work was organized. And eventually, as it had to happen, they failed one by one. But Marx said, of course, they were destined to fail because their conceptions were not materialist. They were just idealist and relying sort of on the goodwill of capitalists, which just ain't there. He didn't think capitalists were evil, by the way. He thought that they were exploiters, they oppressed people, but that their ideas and their behavior were shaped by the material interest. And, you know, he would ridicule their ideas and their behavior in Volume 1 of Capital and other places. But he says in some of his introductions, really, it's just sort of for, well, public relations or something like that. He said, I don't really condemn them. I mean, just they're shaped by the system the way everyone else is shaped by the system. And the point isn't really to punish capitalists, but to get rid of the system. And he entertained the idea that if socialism could be established, well, then capitalists should just become part of the new society and just work and behave as ordinary people do. He was not interested in vengeance. He didn't think capitalism was a result of evil or greed or anything like that. It's just the sort of system that is going to produce very greedy, aggressive people. It has to, in the same way that it produces pollution. And no one really wants pollution to be produced, but it's inevitable given the priorities of a corporation, its desire to maximize profit, it's going to pollute. So he works toward a notion of socialism based partly on what the utopian socialists were saying, but putting a material foundation underneath it. And he said, basically, societies must be driven by economic interest. Everybody connects somehow with the economy, even if you don't work. You're being supported by someone who's supported by someone who works or owns or is a manager, something like that. What drives society, and he knew society's changed. He was deeply steeped in Hegel, the German philosopher, who had an encyclopedic knowledge of history. Hegel was an idealist, but still his history couldn't be contested, and Marx knew even more than Hegel eventually. So he saw societies are always changing. The notion that any society is fixed or permanent is ridiculous. Sometimes it won't change much over the course of a century, but if you look at it long enough, it changes. He said this must be due to technological change. Problems arise in production. Maybe the soil in a certain place isn't very fertile, so you come up with some other way of getting it fertile. Maybe you use animal fertilizer or maybe synthetic fertilizer. But almost every important advance of a technological nature has something to do with real needs. Society as a whole is confronting a problem, confronting a crisis, and it's going to try to solve that crisis by means of a better kind of plow or a better kind of harness on horses or on oxen or, you know, a supercomputer. They didn't exist in his day, but, you know, he would understand exactly what the evolution of the computer is always about. So technological change is somehow driving social change. But then he asked himself, well, what about revolutions? People had known about revolutions for thousands of years. The Roman Empire had lots of revolutions. The Chinese had revolutions. He didn't discover revolutions. The American Revolution had just occurred. The French Revolution had just occurred. He wrote the Communist Manifesto because revolutions were about to break out all over the continent, or the western part of the European continent. So that had to be explained. Why occasionally was there a revolution? Was this a response to technological change? Well, yes and no. Technology was always changing, and yet revolutions didn't always happen. They seemed to happen occasionally. Sometimes there would be a social order, and it would be kind of stable for a few centuries. as feudalism was. And then almost overnight, there would be this incredible change. So he said there must be an obstacle to change, to social change, that's somehow connected with technology. And he lit upon the idea that the interests of every dominant class, if a society is divided into classes, are somehow bound up with a particular technology. And that at some point, technology will begin, or the development of technology will begin to undermine their rule. In other words, they're going to stop, or try to stop, they're going to try to arrest the development of technology. And in the act of doing that, they're going to cause almost all of society besides themselves to suffer. And it's the universal suffering of a society due to that strangulation of what he called the development of productive forces that's going to make people rise up, no matter how complacent they've been, no matter how obedient they've been to rulers. When they cannot feed their children at least one meal a day, they're going to rise up, and they could do it very, very quickly. The most obedient, complacent people in a matter of months can say, well, we've had enough of the Tsar or the British monarch or whoever. And then their forces, it's like a tornado, it cannot be stopped. And they will get rid of the old order that's blocking technological social progress, and they'll bring in some new order. Let me give an example, a very famous example of how that happened. We have a conception of feudalism and capitalism. It came from Marx. He expressed it for the first time in the Communist Manifesto. Now, what was feudalism really all about? Well, it was about manors, isolated feudal manors, each of which was owned by some aristocrat. The serfs were bound to the land. They couldn't leave unless the owner said, okay, you can leave for a day or two to, you know, attend a wedding or something. But generally speaking, they were not allowed to leave. And they were kept pretty much illiterate, or as illiterate as the owners could, with the church in heavy attendance in order to rationalize the rule of the aristocracy. The church would say, well, God put these people in their positions. God ordained that someone's going to be the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire and the king of France and the duke and the prince and this and that. And it's your job to be obedient to these people, because if you don't follow their orders, you're going to be in hell the rest of your, well, you know, after you die, hell forever. So superstition was the order of the day, and the steady campaign against literacy. And also, the feudal aristocrats weren't interested in very much infrastructure. They didn't need harbors. They didn't need rational system of weights and measures. They didn't need extensive roads. They didn't need the support of technological development, scientific labs. They didn't need anything like that. They certainly didn't want to be taxed by a government to pay for all of that. So taxes were levied on the French people, but it wasn't on the aristocracy. They all fell on industrialists and on workers and on independent farmers. And a lot of farmers were still serfs, even at the time of the revolution. They couldn't leave the land. Many of them were artisans, and they could have done very well for themselves in cities, but they weren't allowed to leave. The capitalists also were deprived of labor. Their workshops and their factories were growing. They couldn't get labor because it was locked into the land. The serfs were connected to the manor. And so at some point around the mid-1780s, lots of people began to suffer because there could be very few agricultural improvements, because agriculture was not being sponsored by anyone. No one could undertake it. The soil was losing its fertility. People in the cities were heavily taxed so that the aristocracy wouldn't be taxed. All of society was suffering. They finally rose up, and they got rid of the feudal order and the aristocracy. Now, there was a period of turmoil of 5 or 6 years where different classes were fighting one another to see who would be the new ruling class, and it became the capitalists. Was this because the capitalists were brilliant, or there's something unique about them, or the communists? Marx called himself a communist after the communards, who actually used arms to further their class interest after the monarchy was toppled. It was that they weren't well enough organized, or the propaganda was wrong. No. Let me invite you to consider some water in the liquid state. Let's say it's 40 degrees Fahrenheit. You cool it down to 32.1 degrees, and it's still water. You get it to 32 degrees, and suddenly it coalesces into a lattice that we call ice. And if you could see it under an electron microscope, you could see, you know, a lattice work. It's, there are molecules of H2O, and they connect with one another in a lattice, and it's always the same. You can take 1,000 containers of water and cool them to 32 degrees, and the lattice is always the same. Now, Marx never said this, but my background is in physics, actually. I try to explain social phenomena in physics terms. I say human beings are pretty much the same. They are attracted to one another. just the way molecules are, because molecules may be neutral electrically, but if you look at them in detail, they're positive here and negative there. They attract one another. That's why you can have solids. So they're attracted to one another, but then they're repelled from one another by the energy that's bombarding them. Now, when water is at the temperature above 32 degrees, the bombardments it's getting from the container are such that the forces that cause them to cohere cannot produce a lattice. And you have molecules bouncing around. Those near the surface would sort of like to get out, but they're attracted in by molecules below them, although some have enough energy to evaporate. However, when you go below 32 degrees, they have very little energy, and then their attractive forces prevail. And physicists say, well, there's a change of state. So why not say that all revolutionary transitions are like that? That humans are cooperating in a certain way under certain conditions. What conditions? Technological conditions, climate conditions, the distribution of natural resources, the nature of neighbors. Those are the conditions that are shaping the way people cooperate in production. And if technology changes, and maybe natural resources change because they get exhausted, or someone invades, the climate changes, then they have to undergo a phase change. They must go from, let's say, feudalism to capitalism. And eventually they'll have to go from capitalism to socialism. In other words, no one planned feudalism. No one planned capitalism. No one knew in 1400 that one day Europe would be capitalist. As Marx put it, history takes place behind the backs of the actors. They must do these things for the sake of survival, and it's because they must organize production in a certain way based on conditions. And his argument basically is that capitalism is thriving now. It was progressive by comparison with feudalism. It allowed for the further development of productive forces, mostly technology. At some point, he thought that maybe in his lifetime, obviously it wasn't, capitalist interests will strangle the further development of technology. At that point, all of humanity will suffer, because probably all of humanity will be in one gigantic interlocked capitalist system. At that point, people will have no choice but to rise up and use arms to abolish the system. I mean, his reasoning was, well, no ruling class in history ever just resigned or allowed itself to be voted out of power. They can always justify the extreme use of power to themselves, and they try to justify it to everybody else. So having a vote or appealing to their sense of morality is futile. I mean, it would have to be an armed struggle. How long it would take, where it would start, where it would end, he didn't know. No one could know. But he felt that that was the dynamic of the capitalist system. In fact, if you read the beginning of the Communist Manifesto, he has nothing but praise for the system. He says, we have electricity now, and messages are sent around the world instantaneously. We have steam power that is much greater than human power. We build gigantic bridges and factories. We have tremendous output that was never possible under any preceding economic order. So capitalism, for him, was very progressive by comparison with anything that had come before. But he said it has its time. Sooner or later, the capitalist relations of production will strangle the further development of the forces of production. People will suffer, and they'll have to do the necessary thing. His classic statement of this whole question was the following. It was part of his preface to a certain work he published in 1859. It was the kind of prelude to Volume 1 of Capital. He said, in the production that men carry on, they enter into definite relations of production that are indispensable and independent of their will. They must go from feudalism to capitalism. Whatever they want, whatever they hope for, whatever they design in their wildest dreams is very interesting. But what was necessary, which was indispensable and independent of their will, was capitalism. And he welcomed it because at least it abolished feudalism, you know, which kept people really ignorant and backward and dispersed over the countryside, whereas he felt that the modern working class concentrated in very large cities, more or less literate and able to organize, with no stake in the given society, would be the revolutionary class that would liberate humanity finally and have an egalitarian society. And he didn't say that the working class is going to do it because it's very moral or very this or that or the other. He said it's just a matter of physical necessity. They won't be able to continue life under capitalism. And whatever mode of production, as he would put it, follows, it can't allow workers to take home individual pieces of machinery at the end of every day. Capitalism socializes production in gigantic factories. The factories of today are even larger than what he knew about. Production must be social in nature, and therefore the cooperation of the whole of humanity must be social and democratic. And that was his vision of a socialist future. I mean, it hasn't come to pass, but you can see, first of all, capitalism finally spreading all over the world, industrial capitalism, and workers being oppressed by the same companies. Someone who works for General Motors in Shanghai, you know, is an employee just like the people who work in Detroit or in Brazil for General Motors. Furthermore, it's obvious that the rulers of China, you know, were well integrated with the rulers in America and the rulers in France and Britain. I mean, it's a global ruling class. That's one of the meanings of globalization. So that when the time comes, the workers in China will have no choice but to overcome their prejudices and illusions and unite with workers in Brazil or the United States or France or wherever they may be to abolish a system that oppresses them. And so it's not the morality of workers or their sensitivity that will produce socialism. It will just be sheer material need. Humanity at some point will have no choice but to bring in a more humane system. Now, that being the case, why should people bother to spread the word, as it were? And Marx never really answered that question. I don't know if he even contemplated it. I've thought about it a trillion times. And I guess the role of people who can understand the system would be to accelerate the emergence of a new kind of society. I think somehow individuals or groups of individuals with a new idea do make a difference. If I didn't believe that, you know, I wouldn't be here tonight. So I've spoken at some length. I can go on indefinitely or I can stop now. And, well, let me go on for a little while and talk about his conception of the mode of production. I wanted to get a little into Volume 1 of Capital, but it's a whole other story. He said, let's consider what he called the mode of production. To make a kind of long, complicated story short, he talked about the mode of production of a society being its economic base. And what is a mode of production? It's a combination of two things, relations of production and forces of production. What are the relations of production? Well, in capitalist society, the relations of production are capitalist to wage laborer. In feudal society, it would be feudal lord or aristocrat and serf. Every society could be characterized by relations of production. In a hunting-gathering society, the relations are all democratic. The males will agree to go out on a hunt. Females will agree to go out and gather. But they're always relations. People do not live on desert islands. They do not live as hermits. They are social. And that's part of what it means to be a normal human being. So there are relations of production, and they interact with the forces of production. Well, what are the forces of production? There are three. There are the workers themselves. There are their implements of production, and there are their knowledge of production. In other words, you can have a supercomputer, but you better know what a computer is before you can use a supercomputer. Or you better know how to use a plow, for that matter, before you can actually produce an output. And these influence one another. For instance, the example I gave in feudalism, I mean, the landlords were not interested in their serfs being highly educated. I mean, they would know whatever they already knew maybe in the 14th century, and here it is the 17th century, and their knowledge hasn't really advanced very much. So the knowledge of production was being held back by them, and also they were not bringing in the latest implements. There were actual mechanical reapers and harvesters being introduced into England in the late 1700s and early 1800s, and not introduced into France, because the aristocracy was so backward. It had, by this time, 1788, 1789, an inherent prejudice against science, just any kind of science, any kind of reason. The Enlightenment philosophers said, well, we live in the age of reason. Well, the aristocrats by this time were against reason. They said, well, it's God's word. That's what you should listen to, and not these people like Robespierre and Voltaire and Rousseau, you know, talking about science and reason. So the relations of production condition the development of the forces of production. Right now, an enormous fraction of American society, American workers, are unskilled or semi-skilled. It's not because they were born incapable of understanding, but capitalists prefer as many people in their workforce to be unskilled as possible. Not just because they can be paid a lower wage, but because they could be more manipulated, because they have low self-esteem. They know they don't have a college degree. Some of them are semi-literate. So under capitalism, technology develops, but it's a crippled kind of development. The capitalists in America especially like to boast about all the money they spend on research, but there are many instances where actually efficiency of a firm and profitability was improved by allowing the workers a greater say in the running of the company. The company in question happened to be Polaroid. something called workers' control and other things like it were introduced in Polaroid, self-directed work teams. And it allowed 3/4 of the shop floor managers to be fired because the workers were directing themselves, while the rest of the managers, lower management, were horrified by that. And then upper management was horrified, saying, well, if we get rid of the middle managers, we're next. And soon the workers are going to want to be on the board of directors. And pretty soon they're going to say, well, why should we distribute profits to people who know nothing about the productive process? They're not producing anything. We are. I mean, it's not that they were thinking, well, the workers are communists, but one thing leads to another. And so Polaroid reversed this interesting experiment and reverted to an older form of relations of production that was actually less profitable than the job enrichment self-directed work team regime. So that gives you some idea of how the forces of production develop within capitalism. It's not that the best technology will be used. It's that technology which accords with the relations of production. In this society, accords with the interests of the capitalist class. And you could see that there might come a point where further development of the technology will actually imperil the existence of the class. And at that point, when they choke off further development, you can expect universal misery. Now, the misery can take other forms, for instance, the exhaustion of certain natural resources, such as oil and water, the extreme degradation of the environment, which obviously is a consequence of the way capitalists operate. They want to save on costs, and not putting in a scrubber on some kind of a smokestack is good. You save $10,000. Of course, there's more garbage in the society. People are poisoned. I mean, who knows what will be the death knell of capitalism? But it's somehow all connected with the forces and relations of production, and the relations of production are governing what kinds of forces can develop. Now, let's move from the economic base to what Marx called the superstructure, which sits on the base and, in fact, reflects what's going on at the base. Now, the superstructure consists of the state, cultural institutions, religious institutions, the family. They are all being shaped, whether people realize it or not, by what happens in the economic base. Let me give an example. Barbed wire was invented in the end of the 1860s. And it involved steel with barbs on it. And the people using them were the biggest ranchers in places like Wyoming and South Dakota, and, you know, the cattle states. And why were they using them? Well, partly to keep their herds from wandering away. A big rancher might own thousands of acres of land and lots of cattle, but it's not infinite. I mean, the cattle can wander away, and small ranchers could steal the cattle, something they were accustomed to do. All those Hollywood movies you've seen about the ranchers and the small farmers or the cattle raisers and the sheep herders, I mean, to some degree it was true. Not the way Hollywood shows it, but there were real class conflicts. Now, before barbed wire, BBW, small farmers had pretty easy access, according to the law, to lakes and ponds, and even to certain grasslands, so that their cattle could survive. And the big ranchers were especially interested in preventing that from happening, because the small ranchers had a possibility of becoming big ranchers. And also, they were stealing the cattle in these big herds. So there was this class conflict. I think it was the state of Wyoming passed a law saying it was against the law to take down barbed wire. And it was also against the law in certain cases to put up barbed wire. Now, taking down barbed wire was a felony, taking it down illegally, and putting it up was only a misdemeanor. Well, who's going to take it down? Not the small ranchers. Who's going to put it up? Not the small ranchers. They were interested in taking it down. So what they did was a felony, and punishable by a big fine and imprisonment. And the big ranchers who put up barbed wire illegally to prevent the small guys from watering and feeding their cattle, that was only a misdemeanor. So you can see that the base is shaping the superstructure. It is shaping the state. Who's able to buy more politicians, a little rancher or a millionaire? I mean, it's just obvious. The senators, whoever passed these laws, they really had no particular disposition. Had the small ranchers been able to bribe them enough, they would have given them what they wanted. But small business people do not have much money. Big business people do. I mean, it's the same axiom is true today. So the state reflects the interests of the ruling class. It partially rules through the state. What about cultural and religious institutions? Well, let's see what John Rockefeller did with his donations, for instance, to the American Baptist Church. He was a devout Baptist. And he probably believed his own ideology. He said on many occasions when he was criticized for having so much money, God gave me my money. And he said it's good that money should be concentrated in the hands of me and Carnegie and other people because we amass money and we can use them, these masses of money, for philanthropic purposes. We can have big hospitals, we can have research facilities, we can eliminate yellow fever. And obviously when this money is dispersed among many people, they're not going to be able to fund these things. And, you know, we fund museums too, like the Museum of Modern Art, the most prestigious modern art museum in this country, maybe in the world, was founded by John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s wife. And also Peggy Guggenheim, who of the Guggenheim family that owned lots of steel and aluminum, etc. So they founded the thing and they ran it. Now, in the 60s, at the end of the 60s especially, the professionals at the Museum of Modern Art sort of rebelled. They said, we have devoted our lives to the study of art, and therefore we should be the ones to decide what's exhibited. You know, the paintings and sculptures, well, you know, what they should be, how they should be mounted, how they should be described, the pamphlets, the roving exhibitions. And Mrs. John D. Rockefeller Jr. said, no, she was John D. Rockefeller III, sorry. Just like the European royalty, the third, the fourth, the fifth, they have a sense of their own distinction and power. There was a guy who lived a few years ago, Andrew Carnegie Rockefeller VI or something. We now have Kerry. His wife is a Hines, and Henry J. Hines IV is a U.S. senator. So the American aristocracy is exactly like other aristocracies. These people, you know, with decades of art history experience behind them, this is at the end of the 60s when, you know, the masses were kind of expressing themselves, said, well, we should be the ones to decide what's considered great art and how it's to be exhibited. And Mrs. Rockefeller said, no, you don't understand. We are the board of directors. We decide and we respect your opinion, but we make the ultimate decisions. Now, what in the world were they so afraid of? Well, there was a little incident that occurred in Rockefeller Center around 1933 that involved Nelson. Nelson was a young man at that time, and Rockefeller Center was just getting built. If you've ever seen it, it's just gigantic buildings that were put up with very low-wage labor because people in the Depression were delighted to get any kind of job. So he was sort of given control over the development of this gigantic project. And he asked his friends, he was very interested in art himself, by the way. His private collection became the collection of the Museum of Primitive Art, the most prestigious primitive art museum in the world. In fact, before he built it, primitive art was sort of not recognized as art. It was just sort of things that, masks that were done in Africa. But he said, no, this is art. He had a lot of advisors to tell him that it was art. Alfred Barr Jr. was one of them. So he asked around, who's a great painter or muralist? And lots of people said, well, Diego Rivera, one of the three great Mexican muralists. So he hired him and he paid him some relatively small amount of money for our time, big for that time, $50,000 or something, to put a mural into the RCA building. Using lots of art students, I think from Columbia or NYU, he designed the thing and they were painting it. And what they were showing was John D. Rockefeller and his friends playing bridge while prostitutes with syphilis were plying their trade on the streets. He also showed a scene from a Rockefeller-owned factory. Workers were kind of manacled into a machine, and they would put some raw material into a clamp and then move their hands back. And as soon as they moved their hands back, a blade came down and sliced the metal. And so when it was sliced and the parts were removed, then they would go in and again and do it. And the reason they were manacled is that the managers wanted to make sure they didn't lop off their own hands. Well, that got in. And, oh, you know, all kinds of scenes of exploitation and misery contrasted with extraordinary wealth and even John Rockefeller Sr. in the scene. So Nelson didn't like this. And yeah, there was a picture of Lenin. I think Diego Rivera was a member of the Mexican Communist Party at the time. There were lots of objectionable features. And Rockefeller brought Rivera in and he said, look, if you were doing this for my own home, as a painting or as a mural, it would be okay. I wouldn't mind. But the public is going to see this. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are going to go through that lobby every year. I mean, it's like 60 or 70 stories tall, and they're going to work there. So it's just not appropriate. So Rivera stuck to his guns, and Rockefeller finally called in security, and he said, well, we guarantee that we're just going to cover up the painting. It'll be there for future generations. Well, that's not what happened. workers came in, they chiseled the mural off, and I think photos of that it still exists, or maybe the original plans exist. But that's really what was on the mind of Mrs. Rockefeller. Like, what kind of paintings and sculptures are these people, many of whom were young, and they're all in New York City, which is, you know, not a backward hamlet. What kind of stuff are they going to put in? And the Museum of Modern Art draws people from all over the world. It probably has millions of visitors per year, and they're going to be seeing this stuff. So we can't let them see progressive art. And there was a lot of progressive art being produced at that time in this country and in places like Vietnam and in places like Cuba. And just imagine what would happen if the amazing resources of the Museum of Modern Art were bent in a new direction. So here's an instance of how a cultural institution, which seems to be innocent, just as abstract expressionism appears to be innocent, reflects the relations at the base. What about the family? Well, we now have a very high rate of divorce in this country. In fact, the rate of divorce in China and India is soaring. Why? Well, women are entering the workforce. They're having an independent wage. They can sustain themselves. Their wage is maybe only 3/4 of that, or their salary, 3/4 of that of men, but still it's enough to live on. So women are saying, or they have been saying in this society for 30, 35, 40 years, why should I subordinate myself to a man who is abusive or condescending? I don't need any particular man to survive. Maybe I'd like to have a husband, I'd like to have a family someday, but right now is not the right time for me. So women are having fewer children. The birth rate has been falling in this society for 40 or 50 years because they got to go out to work. Now we have double income families and shrinking birth rate. We have a high immigration rate to make up for the fact that native-born Americans are not reproducing themselves enough. But you can see how the family is being shaped by the economic base. By the way, without vacuum cleaners, without washing machines, without all that stuff that can mechanize housework, this would be impossible. I think it was estimated that in 1900, typical housewife was spending 70 hours a week, 80 hours a week doing housework. There would be such a thing as spring cleaning. There were no vacuum cleaners. They couldn't clean carpets that way, so they had to do it by hand. People in 1900 made their own soap. They made their own bread. They made their own furniture. They canned fruits. They canned vegetables. Well, all of this has been mechanized and industrialized, and the prices accordingly have come down over the long run. And so that too is part of women's liberation. Without all of that, women could not leave the household, even if they were offered a reasonable wage. So all these things going on in the base, like canned fruit and vegetables, or like the invention of the washing machine and the vacuum cleaner, they're all happening in the base, and no one is contemplating ultimate social effects. But sooner or later, it's going to hit even the family. And finally, on top of it all is what Marx called ideology. In other words, there are institutions such as the state, the media, schools, museums, you know, all these cultural institutions that are producing an ideology that's swaying people one way or another. And this, of course, feeds back into the base, because the better the propagation of ideas that correspond to the interests of the ruling class, perhaps the better the working class can be kind of kept in line. Now, in Marx's day, there were very few managers. Managers are like a conveyor belt, or like an intermediary between capital and labor. But in our day, managers are a distinct class, and they too play a social role. And managers and professionals are very ambivalent. Like the higher level ones who are getting paid $3 million a year by General Motors, they will identify with General Motors. Whereas a shop floor manager in General Motors might identify with the workers because he or she has come from that class. The situation ideologically is very, very complicated. And every situation sort of has to be analyzed on its own. And all of this is contained in that document I mentioned to you that was written in 1859. Marx expresses it in a matter of one paragraph using this kind of vocabulary. So I've kind of expanded on it. I think I really should stop at this point. My next step would have been to explain the capitalist mode of production, but that'll perhaps have to wait for some other occasion.
It's been absolutely fascinating. Oh,
thank you.
You have been listening to Dr. Ira Sohn's lecture titled The Materialist Conception of History. This completes part two of the full three-part program. It was recorded on June 18th of 2004 in Santa Monica, California. The talk was sponsored by the Southern California Federation of Scientists and the monthly review discussion group. Dr. Sohn holds degrees in physics and economics and currently teaches economics at universities both in the U.S. and China. This program was produced by the L.A. Sound Posse. The L.A. Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.